Living in America, in the time and age that we do, there are certain things that we are just used to. Religious freedom feels very normal to us. Economic freedom feels very normal to us. The ability to come here every Sabbath and not be worried about people seeing us come here, or, you know, maybe upset about the things that we say. The ability to go to work that we have and earn money and buy the things we need at a store without asking anybody's permission, as much as we want the thing as we can afford. It all feels normal. Throughout human history, if you look at it, much of what we have in America, the modern world, in terms of economic and religious freedom is just not normal. In fact, it's been exceedingly rare. You know, governments have tightly controlled economies. In fact, the level of freedom in general in the world that most countries and their people enjoy is at a, I would say, at a high within human history. You know, at various times, governments would decide much more strictly who could trade, who could travel, who could work as what and where, who could worship and how. If you look at the Protestant Reformation in Europe as kind of a case study in that, it got very bad. It's like, if you're in France, you can only be a this kind of Protestant thing. You can't be a Catholic and you can't be a Baptist. You got to be a Huguenot. I don't remember. The Huguenots are just one. That's one of those like things I learned about in history class. I don't remember who they were or what they did. But it was that way, right? For a lot of history where, like, if you weren't on board with the official state religion, like, you had to really watch out. We don't have a lot of countries with official state religions anymore. You know, it's not so much a thing. The world has secularized and separated church and state in a way, you know, as we do in America. So our modern freedoms in those regards are by far the exception. Yet, the book of Revelation describes an end-time government system that is going to be a lot less like what we have now and a lot more like those very restrictive regimes that control worship and commerce. And of course, I'm talking about what's known as the beast, the government of the beast that is going to have that kind of control over worship and economics that you could say is antithetical to the American system that we have now. Right? You know, those are not currently the American-led system that the whole world is kind of operating under. It just doesn't have those kind of restrictions. For, you know, nearly 100 years now, America has dominated the global order militarily and economically and technologically. And, you know, when America moves on something, the world moves. Have you heard this one economically with stock markets? When America sneezes, the rest of the world gets the flu. You know, even like, you know, our problems cascade to them as much bigger problems. And the decisions that we make as a country basically dictate what the rest of the world has to do. Right? There are reasons for that. There are numbers behind that that I'll give you later on. But when you read Bible prophecy, you know, about the return of Jesus Christ, there's really nothing in there that speaks to America being any kind of player at all, really. Not a dominant power to be mentioned in end-time politics. So what that tells us is that the current geopolitical order is going to change. And it's going to change not in the favor of the country that we're citizens of. With that change, the underlying system of values, especially the Bible-based values that have led to religious freedom and economic freedoms, are going to be unseated by other ideas. To fulfill prophecy, the world will not and cannot stay the way that it is today. So we're going to talk about what that system is and if and how we can see ourselves moving closer to it every day. So we're going to examine three things: what the Bible actually says about the beast system, what conditions must exist for the beast to rise and be in place, and thirdly, how current global trends are creating those pathways towards that reality, and, you know, what that means for us spiritually. So let's start with what the Bible says about that end-time government known as the beast. If we turn to Daniel chapter 2, Daniel chapter 2 is where we find Nebuchadnezzar's dream, interpreted by Daniel. Really cool story. It'd be fun if I could spend a little more time on it today, but it's not so much the purpose. You know, he had a dream, and they were used to people having dreams and interpreting them. He said, no. If you're going to interpret my dream, you gotta tell me what the dream was and then interpret it. Because you guys would just make stuff up left and right, right? And everyone was really upset. He would get killed them all if they didn't tell him the dream. They're like, the king's asked an impossible thing. No one can tell him the dream. Daniel says, oh no, there's a God in heaven that interprets dreams, and it's my God, and I'll come and tell you the dream and do this. This is where we find, and I'll just give the overview, verses 31 through 35 describe the dream, which was of a great statue. We know this statue well if we've been in the church, but it had a head of gold, and then it had the chest and arms of silver, had the waist and the thighs of bronze, and then the legs became iron down to the toes, mixed of iron and clay, right? So you've got this statue that Daniel reveals to the king and for us, for all people, according to the Bible, that these four medals on the statue represented four world-ruling empires, starting with you, O King Nebuchadnezzar, starting with Babylon, and cascading down right to the end times. Let's read that in verse 40 of Daniel chapter 2. We'll read 40 through 44 while we're here. Daniel 2:40. So skipping to the fourth kingdom, because this is the one that's going to be there, the beast power at the return of Christ. It says, the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. So that tells us that this fourth kingdom would be the one that is going to rule the world and exist down to the time of the return of Christ. And it even indicates a change, right? It goes from being just iron to, when you get down to the toes on the feet, this mix of iron and clay and this kind of looser alliance. This is a very broad strokes prophecy, but we understand through other prophecies and through history that fourth empire was the Roman Empire initially that took over. So it went the Babylonians, the Persians, then you had the Greek Empire was the bronze, then the Roman Empire represented by iron from there. And throughout history, there have been a number of different revivals of the Roman Empire, and there's a lot to be said on that. But we're talking mostly, we just need that as our anchor and background. That's things that we probably should already know. If we don't, we can prove that another time and talk about it. But you get down to the end times, the time when that kingdom will be destroyed, and it's in this state where you've got these 10 toes, and they are mixed of iron and clay. Right, and it talks about how they're going to have the strength of iron, but they're going to be partly strong, partly fragile, and just like iron and clay don't mix, it's not going to be held together very well. Later, in other prophecies we'll look at, you'll see these 10 toes also depicted as 10 horns on a beast, and then we're told explicitly elsewhere that they represent 10 kings. So we'll look at that. But before I get to those things, let's talk a little bit about more what's here. Some of the words that I just haven't really focused on as much is it talks about this being potter's clay. Or some translations, anybody have like Old King James where it says miry clay, right? Like I never thought about what that word miry meant, but actually it's talking about the clay like that's on the potter's wheel when it's in that state, pre-baked. Okay, so you're talking about like the mushy clay that can be molded. So that's what's holding the iron together in this case. So when it talks about the kingdom being brittle, we think of clay, like clay when it's cooked is brittle, right? And it's kind of using both sides of the clay here for this, right? But if you just imagine that potter's clay, like a lump of it, sticking chunks of iron in it, eventually it's going to like sag and droop and the iron's just going to like not stay in very well. So, those people's minds, you had different imagery playing in on that we can tap into. These materials used to be a lot more common in the world. Most of us have probably like in art class in elementary school made something out of clay, right? And the teacher takes it and bakes it in the oven later. I don't know where they do that, but yeah, they bring it back. And I remember I had a little frog that I made one time, and the big mouth was open. You could put stuff in it and stuff. But you know, generally, we don't have a lot of interaction with clay, and not a lot of our stuff is made out of iron either. Right, like we don't have like iron swords sitting around and things. If we have a weapon, it's typically you know something else. But you know, in their time, a lot of their farm implements would be made of iron, and it's you know big, heavy metal, and it's very hard, very strong. Right, and this was basically in that world in that time what powered the Roman Empire. It was the most common hard metal that you could make good weapons out of. You know, before that, the things that they had were bronze, which was an alloy of copper and tin. Tin was very rare, right? So, like, it was hard to make a lot of bronze weapons. So, iron is really what enabled the Roman Empire to scale to the size that it did, to have armies big enough that are equipped enough with iron weapons, all that kind of stuff. So, you've got the miry clay. So, you've got the imagery of it being muddy and malleable and not very good at holding things together. But it, even when it's baked, you know, it's a very cheap material. It's a very weak material. It's brittle. You bang it on the counter and it falls apart. And it's not something you spend any time to fix. You just kind of throw it away, is the way clay was. But it'll have the strength of iron in it. So, you have that strongest, commonly available metal. Significantly, it said it will, this empire with the strength of iron will break in pieces and crush all the others. So that means that specifically it is going to break the power of other nations. That's part of what this did. That was what the Roman Empire did. It made basically every other nation a vassal state. And you could be part of the Roman Empire without being a Roman. In fact, that was a big deal to be a Roman citizen. If you look at the life of Paul, for example, he was a Roman citizen. That gave him a lot of rights, gave him a lot of credibility, which he was able to use in his ministry and all that. But you know, most people ruled by the Roman Empire were not actually citizens of the Roman Empire, right? They were just vassal states all over the world. Which is interesting. So breaking the power of those nations, you know, you could still be a person from this or that country, and you're of that nation. You're not a Roman, but you live in a Roman world. What's the sense? Okay, so this is telling us some interesting things about the form that this final world ruling power is going to take just before what happens in the prophecy. The stone, which represents Jesus Christ, strikes the statue and makes the whole thing crumble. And basically, God puts an end to these human governments and the rule by human governments. Good. So we've got that in place. And let's turn to Daniel chapter 7. And we'll look at just a couple of things there to nail down some of the concepts before we move on. Daniel chapter 7 gives us the same sequence of four empires as Daniel 2 does. But instead of metals, it describes them as four beasts, right? So each beast is, you know, kind of scary. It represents a nation. You get down to the fourth beast, the one that's analogous to that end time government, the end time beast of Revelation, and this government of iron and clay and the ten toes. That beast is described in Daniel 7 as being like iron. It's described as dreadful, terrible, exceedingly strong. Let's see, that's in verse 7 of Daniel chapter 7. The fourth beast is dreadful, terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth, right? It was devouring, breaking in pieces, trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. All right, so later in the chapter, verse 24, it says explicitly, the 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom. And another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue 3 kings. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High. So specifically with this fourth beast, you've got 10 kings, and you've got another horn that rises in the midst of them and causes some trouble and all this stuff. It's speaking pompous words, right? And words specifically against God. And verse 25, shall persecute the saints of the Most High. And, now we're looking at exerting authority, shall intend to change times and law. And the saints will be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. So Biblically, that phrase time, times, and half a time represents 3 years. A time is a year. Times would be more than one time. It's two times. So a time and times, two of them, is three. And half a time makes three and a half, is how that has been understood. So this is indicating that that final government at the return of Christ, this one that's like iron, that's breaking other nations in pieces and all this stuff, is going to be making war with the people of God. So you've got this religious element mixed in. Which I kind of stated without qualification in the introduction, so we're getting to that. So there's going to be some persecuting of the people of God, so there's a religious element involved right there, which we'll flesh out a little more. It's going to be changing laws and times, right? So that is changing the system of government to be against the way of God, against the laws of God and the times of God, is how we've understood that. The government, in other words, in the end time, is going to be set against the people of God in a number of multiple different ways. That's what we're seeing. All right, so with that in mind, we can go look at Revelation 13. Revelation 13. This is one of those topics where, you know, like it says in Isaiah, the word was given to them, here a little, there a little, line upon line, precept upon precept. We kind of have to look at the whole picture and little pieces of it and only zoom in on one thing at a time to understand anything. Revelation 13, in verse 1, setting the stage, I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his head a blasphemous name. All right, so we've got, again, this imagery of 10 horns on a beast. This is another government, or the same government that's being talked about with the 10 toes and with iron and clay, and the same one as that fourth beast with the 10 kings and the one that speaks pompous words that we saw in Daniel 7. Now we're seeing another prophecy of that same end-time beast power coming up out of the sea in this case. Verse 5 says, he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. So tying to what we just read in Daniel 7, 42 months is the same span of time as time, times, and half a time. That's 3.5 years. And this sounds very much like that little horn that rises up, right? A mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, right? Speaking against the Most High is how it was put there. So we're seeing, you know, another prophecy here of the same time period in the same government system that's being described. Hold your place here. I know we're jumping around a lot. Hold your place here because we're going to come back to Revelation 13 in just a minute. Revelation 17 and verse 12 through 14, we get a little more information that we need to stitch into the picture. Revelation 17:12 is back on this image of the beast. It says, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. So a short-lived reign of 10 kings. Why is it going to be short-lived? Well, because it's a mix of iron and clay, right? It's the same 10 toes that are not held together very well. It's very brittle, so it can't exist for very long. You know, no alliance or coalition like that can, but they're going to have power with the beast. They're going to have power with the beast for this 1 hour. Verse 13 says, they are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. And these will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. For he's the Lord of lords and King of kings. Those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. So we can see these are all talking about the same period of time, the same government system, because significantly it's the one that's there when Jesus Christ returns with the saints. And, you know, for our part, we definitely want to be part of this group that are called, chosen, and faithful, that are there with the King of kings and Lord of lords. It's going to defeat this awful beast. But we see that this beast, with a few things about it, it's going to be strong enough to dominate the world, to break the power of other nations. It's going to be divided enough that it needs this kind of very charismatic, you know, mouth speaking great things, kind of energetic personality to draw them together into alliance. And they are going to have the strength of iron when they come together to do that, because they're a significant group when they're together, but it's going to be brittle like clay. So now back to Revelation verse 13, where we can talk about a little bit of One of those things I started with about how the nature of this beast government is different than the American-led system that we have had and known all of our lives and for the last 100 years or so. Revelation 13 and verse 16. So there are some miracles that occur. You know, the leader of the beast power, the false prophet, is given, verse 15, power to give breath to the image of the beast. And so there's this great miracle. And it causes people to worship the image of the beast. And it says it causes as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. And then verse 16, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand and on their foreheads, that no one may buy or sell except the one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. All right, so the mark of the beast, right, is one of these ideas that gets a lot of discussion because it's a very interesting thing that's being said. It's like, wow, we really want to watch out for that, make sure I'm not like taking this mark by accident or by not understanding or definitely not intentionally or anything. But that's not really our purpose today talking about this. You know, I'm looking at the nature of the government system that's going to produce laws, regulations, policies like this, and how it's different than the system we live in today. So it says he causes, verse 16, he causes all, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive this mark. It's an interesting word, right? He causes them to. You look into that word, you look in different translations, you know, some translations will say forces them to, or requires them to. But the word can also just mean makes, like he makes them do it. What's that really saying? So it's saying that this government will have complete economic influence and dominance, right? The ability to cause everybody to have to do it this way. It doesn't matter if you're Elon Musk. It doesn't matter if you're living in a trailer park. You're going to have to do it this way, right? This would just be the new system of commerce for the whole world. Right now, there's no power that can really do that because of American influence, right? Like, we wouldn't accept that. You're not going to tell me how I can spend my money. That's anti-American. You know, that's what our whole system's built on. It's the underpinnings. Okay, so we're looking at a whole system makeover and a power that has that much influence economically that's not America. Verse 15, so he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, and I kind of read over this quickly, that the image of the beast should both speak and, here's that word again, cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. So he can't really cause people to worship it, but he can heavily incentivize not worshiping the beast, causing them to be killed. All right, so that element of religious freedom that I talked about. Oh, yeah, you don't have to worship the beast, but if you don't, somebody's going to show up at your door and kill you. Like, that's kind of what it's saying, right? This is war against the saints that it's talking about, right? And really anyone that won't bow down to it. No major government power on earth is like this. It's hard to imagine America transforming to that point where we become a religious state. There are people that will have theories different than what the Church of God has taught, that America is the beast or this, that, and the other. And generally, those theories just don't hold up very well. I don't have time to dispel all of them and go through all of it, but great after services conversation if you'd like to have it. Okay, so between these two things, verses 15 and 16, the mark and causing people to take the mark and causing people to be killed who will not worship the beast, we are seeing a system and a power that will have not just influence, but also enforcement ability, whether through law or whatever, to control how people worship and control how they do commerce. So it's not just like the beast is going to try to convince people, in other words. It's not like you're just going to have a religious leader that comes and just convinces a lot of people to go ahead and not worship God and worship this image and convinces people to take this mark or whatever. No, this is going to be required and enforced systematically, government level. If you don't comply with this, then boom, you're like an enemy of the state, basically. right? In jail and worse, killed. So all that means the following must be true. You've got to have a centralized authority strong enough to and influence to regulate commerce for the whole world with worldwide implications. You've also got to have infrastructure capable of controlling transactions, which, you know, looking at kind of prophetic milestones, that's maybe another one that has slipped by. Like, you know, for the beast to control all this, you can't really have people walking around handing cash back and forth, because then people can buy and sell and they don't have to have a mark, right? Right? Like, you know, we're now at a time with digital payments and all the things where a system like this can arise, where before that, you could say maybe it couldn't. You know, we've always had Caesar on the coin. You know, Christ famously, you know, pointed that out. This is going further than just having something printed on the currency, right? Also, you have to have a government system that is the dominant government system that has abandoned the concept of religious liberty and the idea of separating church and state. It's going to be very much involved in people's religious lives. All right, before we talk about current events and the prophecies that are taking us on the road to a system like that, that we can see in the news headlines, I think, every day and more, let's just make a quick note about America and prophecy. So to state our church's understanding of American prophecy, we believe that the United States of America, as well as the other English-speaking peoples of the world, are the descendants of the tribes of Israel. That aside from the English-speaking peoples, you also have the tribe of Judah that is talked about in prophecy, is the nation that's called Israel today in the Middle East, that is the Jews. And looking at these prophecies we've talked about and how different it is from the American system, we ask the question, where would America be in the middle of all this? And how do we get from here to something like that? One answer prophetically to that is found in Hosea chapter 5, verses 6 and 7. This is one I think about a lot when I watch the news and see, you know, basically any protest about anything in America, you always have a contingent of people holding up signs that say Free Palestine. Like, it doesn't matter if they're, like, if it's a protest about, you know, against Israel or not. A protest about anything, you got people holding the signs saying Free Palestine. You have a certain contingent of the world that's very much against the modern nation of Israel, against the Jews and their claim to that area. But what I think about is Hosea 5, verses 6 and 7. Which is talking about the nations of Israel and Judah. So prophetically, that's the English people, speaking peoples of the world, including America, as well as the modern state of Israel, the Jews. It says, "With their flocks and herds, they shall go to seek the Lord, but they will not find him. He has withdrawn himself from them," which is a scary thought, the idea of God withdrawing himself from a people. Verse 7 says, why? They have dealt treacherously with the Lord. Okay, so Israel and Judah, having dealt treacherously with the world, with the Lord, God is going to begin to withdraw from them, even if they start to seek him at this point. It says, for they have begotten pagan children. That is, they have allowed their whole society to drift towards things that are not of God, worshiping other gods in whatever different ways. And the end of verse 7 is the critical part. It says, now a new moon shall devour them and their heritage. I think, well, how's the moon going to do that? What it's saying, it's a timeline. If the new moons are how God's months are tracked, and how this prophecy has been understood is that within a month, you will have both Israel and Judah. I missed that part in verse 5. It says, therefore, Israel and Ephraim stumble in their iniquity. Judah also stumbles with them. So when we get to the end of verse 7, a new moon shall devour them and their heritage. It's talking about devouring Israel. So that's it's distinguishing specifically Israel and Ephraim, even though Ephraim's part of Israel, along with Judah. So prophetically, based on our understanding of end time prophecy and who different nations are and how they're represented, our understanding is that America, as well as the other English-speaking peoples, so Britain and Australia and South Africa, other places, all those places, together with Israel, are going to be devoured, and it's going to happen fast. It's going to be within a month that America's influence on the world and the English-speaking influence of the world, traditional Western Christian biblical values that underpin our economic systems and that whole thing of freedom of worship, is going to go away. It's going to go away quickly. And, you know, in a sense, Israel has a lot of those same kind of values, right? So the ability for commerce, it's the only democracy in the Middle East. Also religious freedom. You know, all the people with the Free Palestine signs, a lot of them tend to have values that if they were to go and express those in Palestine, they'd get shoved off a building or killed. But if they are in Israel, they can say whatever they want. They can say death to Israel while you're sitting in Israel. Right? It's freedom of speech and freedom of belief and all those things that they have there. So we have all this in common. And really, if you look at the world, America is one of Israel's only allies, really. In fact, I didn't even know until this morning I was talking to someone that America, as of, I guess it was 9 a.m. local time in Iran, which was sometime last night for us, we started a joint effort attacking Iran. You know, having operations there, and it sounds like from the headlines and the quick bit of the news I got that we are looking to overthrow the regime in Iran, which has been talked about for months. You know, they had all those protests that turned violent. President Trump warned, if you start killing these people, we are going to come and do something about it. And now here we are doing something about it, and it's just more wars and rumors of wars, right? But there we are, you know, fighting side by side with Israel. And we did that, you know, last year over the summer with the operation against Iran's nuclear facilities. So you have a lot of this. And Israel sitting over there in a hot seat with enemies on basically every side. You've got Iran and the Palestinians inside of Israel, and you've got Hamas and Hezbollah and like basically every country around them hating their guts. You've got people all over Europe hating their guts. You even have people in America, like at every rally against anything, hating their guts and holding up signs about it. Like, you just have all of this. And you know, in the Middle East, when they have protests where they shout death to Israel, usually the next thing out of their mouth is death to America. So you can see just by looking at the news, the relationship there and how that rings true with Hosea 5:7, that you know, the same people that want to get rid of Israel are the same people that want to get rid of America and our influence, right? It's the same crowd against both of them. And guess what? In prophecy, both are going to go down at the same time. It's not because our enemies get so strong or so great. It's because our nations abandon God and choose other ways. And I think if we take an honest look at our society, that's happening. Right? It's happening all the time, more and more in front of us, and we're watching it. So this gives our explanation as to how, when this beef power arises, America is not there to oppose it and exert the influence that we have for 100 years. Right? We're not able to stop this different economic system and its different ideas from taking over. We're not able to stop the encroachment on religious freedom that will go throughout the earth. Okay, now let's talk about how we're on the road to the beast. Prophecy, you know, if we look at the long arc, we can look at certain prophecies and say, we are not there yet, right? There are certain milestone events that must take place before Christ can return. For example, the modern nation of Israel. Certain prophecies in the book of Daniel require for end time events to happen that there be Jews in the land of Israel in significant numbers. And prior to 1948, that condition was not met. There were barely any Jews in the land of Israel at that time. Right? And then, you know, you have the whole story of the formation of the state of Israel, and you have had decades, now 70 plus years of Jews from all over the world immigrating and becoming part of that nation in that land. And now, you know, that's a prophetic piece of the puzzle in place where it's like, yeah, those things that it says in Daniel, those can happen now. They couldn't have happened 100 years ago. They could happen now. That doesn't mean that they're about to happen tomorrow, but if that hadn't happened, if we hadn't gotten those Jews there, then this prophecy couldn't take place yet, right? God can always, you know, snap his fingers and get people in places when he needs to. But we see God working things out over a longer arc. Okay, so that's a piece of the puzzle. You know, another one that we talk about and the church has preached about for many years is how in Matthew 24 it says that those days were not cut short. No flesh would be saved alive. Right, the ability of mankind to truly destroy themselves down to the last man has not existed, right? Because before a certain point in warfare, you know, it's like last two guys, you know, drawing their guns on each other. It's like, all right, This is it. All flesh can be destroyed. It's harder to get to. But once you have nuclear weapons, now a peace is in place. And since then, we've added biological warfare and many other ways where if the days were not cut short, all flesh, you know, could be destroyed. No flesh saved alive if these types of weapons are used. Okay? So before those points, that prophecy of Christ couldn't really be fulfilled, but we're at a point in history now where it could be fulfilled. There are other things like that. Other things like right now, I've still got my Bible open to Hosea 5 and verse 7. And right now, the new moon has not yet devoured us and our heritage. Right? So that's one thing we know we're not there yet. When that happens, it's hard to say exactly how long we have. It's probably not very long. But there are other prophetic milestones like this, getting those pieces into place. That doesn't mean the thing is about to happen right then, but it shows God has been and is moving in human history to bring about prophecy. So let's look at some of the things actually happening in the news. I believe that one of the things that's going to take us on the road to the beast power from where we are now is economic instability is going to be a trigger for it. Economic instability is going to be a major trigger. And one of the things leading the way right now is AI disruption within economies. I had planned this and was writing all this before this news story came out, the day before yesterday. Anybody heard of Block, the company Block? Okay, nobody. Anybody heard of Cash App on your phone? You can send money back and forth. Yeah, yeah. Block is the parent company that owns Cash App. Anybody heard of Square? They used to make the little tiles. You plug them into your iPhone. And sometimes if you go to like, you know, a little festival or something, like people take payments that have this little thing attached to their phone so they can take credit card payments. Block is the parent company of Square and Cash App. It's not a small company. They're a $33 billion valuation, right? 10,000 employees. And on Thursday, they announced they are cutting 40% of its workforce. 4,000 jobs gone. And the reason they said why is because with AI tools that have come out, they can cut that much of the workforce and not just keep doing as much as they're doing. They're getting more productivity without that 40% with the AI tools than they would keeping those people without the AI tools. Right? So they're still keeping a productivity increase, but with 40% less people, that's a massive, their stock went crazy going up, up, up because everybody's like, yeah, this is great for earnings. You know, cut all those salaries and you know, so the stock price goes up, but just an interesting thing. On top of that, I've listened to podcasts for several weeks, and I've listened to a lot of AI podcasts, and I've heard engineers and kind of key players at different AI labs at Anthropic and OpenAI, the major companies making, even Google, making the new AI models and tools. And I've heard multiple of them say things like, our team has not written a single line of code ourselves since November. AI writes the code at our direction and we review it, but we haven't written any new code ourselves since November. Some have said December. And it's been multiple different ones, right? Like all saying basically the same things on different interviews that I've listened to. And these are like the companies where the code is the product, right? And you listen to how they talk about it and you'll have like one engineer running 10 AI coders at a time, 10 to 20 of them in parallel, and it's like, okay, this one's done, let me check its output. Okay, this one's done, let me check its output. And it just becomes a totally different job than what they had before. And they're able to move much faster and build much bigger than anyone's ever been able to. So you're getting all these better models available. You know, this stuff, when ChatGPT first came out, it could write code for you, and you could copy and paste it into something and run your own code, and it wasn't very good at it, but it could do it. Okay, so now we've got much better models that can write code that's, you know, as good or better than like 80% of engineers. And then you've also got better tools where instead of copying and pasting, it's right there. It writes it directly into a file that you can then run. And in fact, you don't even have to run it. It'll run it itself. And then if there's a problem, it'll fix the problem itself until it goes. And we're there. Like, I know we're there. This isn't just talk. I actually use these tools. Like, I use them myself. For my own kind of things, I can show you some products that I built and things like that. And I can tell the difference in the last few months. They've gotten that much better where I can ask it to do something. And I just spell it out like, you know, what I need. And it just gets it right the first time. It's that kind of change. The CEO of Block, the company that did those layoffs, said the following. He said, "Something has changed. We're already seeing that intelligence tools we're creating and using are enabling a new way of working, which fundamentally changes what it means to build and run a company." And I think if we think about that in context of what I'm saying in the sermon, it fundamentally changes what it means to build and run a company is the important part. Here's some numbers. The International Monetary Fund has warned that AI will affect about 40% of all jobs globally. The World Economic Forum, so 40% of all jobs globally are going to be affected by AI, according to the IMF. The World Economic Forum reports employer expectations that 40% of employers plan to reduce workforce where AI can automate tasks. Okay, so a lot of companies are already thinking about doing what Block just did. Right, so you know, conveniently for me, in the purpose of this message, they gave an actual case study of exactly the thing that I was going to show up here and tell you anyway. Right, they cut 40% of their workforce, and they're not the only ones thinking about doing this. If we look at the American economy today, our unemployment rate as of January is 4.3%, which is pretty good. Usually, I had to look this up, and I didn't know it offhand, but a good unemployment rate is between 3.5% and 5.5%. Okay, if we're sitting between 3.5% and 5.5%, people are okay, and they think, okay, unemployment rate is fine, right? The 2008 crash. Anybody know what employment hit in America? Unemployment hit in America in 2008? It hit 7.2%. Those are pretty tough times. Like, most of us were alive during those times, and remember, those are pretty tough times. A lot of people out of jobs, a lot of banks collapsing, all kinds of mess. April 2020, COVID, right? When the lockdowns hit, we had a spike in unemployment up to 14.8%. It was short-lived. Within a year, it had gone down to like 6, which is still a couple points higher than it was before all that hit. But 14.8% was the worst unemployment since the Great Depression. The Great Depression, how bad was that? Well, in 1929, just before the Great Depression, unemployment was sitting at a wonderful 3.2%. Within 4 years, by 1933, it had surged to 25%. One difference between kind of all those different spikes and bumps in unemployment and this is that you have a massive influx of new labor. It's not human labor, right? That's the reason the jobs go away. So that number, they said like 40% of employers are planning to reduce the AI workforce. Even if half of all employers cut only 10% of their jobs, that's going to push us over 9% unemployment with jobs that are just never coming back, right? These AI tools are only going to get better from here. And that's another refrain that all these tech gurus say is like, man, this is the worst these tools will ever be. next year, I'll be able to do this with this tool, except much better. And the year after that, it'll be even better. And it's never going to go backwards. It never gets worse at its job and the things we ask it to do. My personal feeling on how this is going to shake out, so just take it for what it's worth, just my kind of opinion on where we're headed. I think that it's very possible that within a year or maybe a little more, we could hit 15 to 20% unemployment that's going to stick much longer than anybody's comfortable. And I think the problem is we could end up in a position like that. And if it's not in a year or two or whatever, it could be further out. I don't know. I'm not a prophet. I'm not making a prophecy here. But if we imagine we get in a situation like that, which is very possible based on where we're at with the technology. But imagine we get there and people are looking. They see no path forward. 15% of people are out of work. Everybody's getting fired left and right because AI took their job. And it's like, well, this job's just not coming back because if another company starts, they're just going to use AI from the get-go. They're not going to hire me. They can't hire me for this, whatever. Like, where does that leave us? And that creates panic. And I haven't even started talking about the jobs the robots are going to take yet because they're working on them too, right? So, like, if you bring that into the mix, it gets even worse because if you can take all the knowledge work and transfer it to AI systems and take all the physical work and transfer it to robots and tell me that's not happening. Has anybody been to Sam's? Anybody been to Sam's and seen the robot that goes around and cleans the floor and that goes around and checks inventory on the shelves? It's already doing human work, right? It's a very simple one. I went to the airport. I flew a few weeks ago, and they had an airport cleaning the floor. They had a robot cleaning the floor of the airport going around. And it makes a lot of sense. You got to clean like tens of thousands of square feet, you know, hundreds of thousands of square feet. That's a much better job for a robot than it ever was for a human cleaning crew, right? Breaking people's backs and whatever. But our economy still depends on those jobs being there. And just like they're eroding there, they're going to continue eroding in more and more ways. It's going to start in factories and warehouses and all these places. Okay, so what happens when suddenly you have this terrible crash in the economy where people see no road forward except for things to get worse because of the same things that got them there? What do people normally do under economic fear and uncertainty? Help! You know, somebody save us. Somebody's got to do something about this. The government's got to step in. They've got to do this. They've got to do that. We got to send everybody stimulus checks. You know what we got to do? We got to keep sending them stimulus checks. We got to rack up more and more of the national debt to send them more and more stimulus checks so they can keep living their lives without having a job. And the job's not coming back, but yeah, we'll do some things to try to create jobs. And by the time they do any of those things, maybe those get gobbled up too. I don't know. But it creates this system where now the government is ready for massive change to address an unprecedented problem. Right? Well, you know, the guys that have been working on this AI stuff for a long time have kind of foreseen this. They're like, okay, this is what's going to happen. We're going to create super intelligent AI, and it's going to take up all the jobs. And people will then, you know, be free to sit around and just relax and have fun while AI and robots do all the work. And to do that, we're going to have to give them money to buy the stuff that AI is producing that's going to line our pockets, which they don't even know what money is going to be anymore. So the way we do that is something like, have you heard the term universal basic income? Anybody heard that term, universal basic income, or UBI? So these, you know, big shots like the Elon Musks and Sam Altman's, the big tech CEOs that have thought this through, the products they're creating, the future they envision, is that they're going to make, you know, money more or less obsolete to the average person because the government's just going to give you a check every week, everybody, you know, whether you're able-bodied or not, there's just no work for you to do because it's done cheaper, more efficiently, and better by AI. And so, you know, we're just going to hand everybody money and let them pursue entertainment and meaning and whatever they want to do. They think that sounds great. The only solution to this problem economically that I've heard from anybody, like I've not heard a single person go out there and say, well, you know, the way free markets work is that we're going to relax, it's going to be a shock, and it's going to hurt for a while, and we're going to create new jobs because you're going to have an influx of human labor, and man, you can start up, you know, all kinds of new businesses that only humans can do, and we can have conveniences and stuff, and let the market solve the problem. Nobody's talked about that. There is, you know, economic theory on that side as to how that problem can be addressed, but nobody's going to be patient enough for that. They're just not. Our society's not set for it. All the influential figures are talking about the fact they're just going to start giving everybody money and let AI and robots do the work. And, you know, what we're talking about is a major step towards away from an American free market system and towards a socialist authoritarian system where everyone is completely, utterly reliant on the government for everything. You know, I think as a society, I think that we have become weak in fortitude in some ways. I don't know that we have the fortitude to endure a Great Depression for 4 years. I don't know that we have the fortitude to endure a period of stagflation like they had in the 80s, you know, late 70s, 80s. I don't think that we have what it takes to endure economic pain for long enough to not do something really foolish that corrupts and breaks our system. You know, say we've grown too fat, too lazy, too comfortable as a society. America's choosing other gods anyway, just left and right, and God is going to remove his blessing from us. That's, you know, that's going to happen one way or another. This is a pathway that I think is plausible to happen and plausible in the near term. So this is a potential how. I think a panic of massive and rapid unemployment spiking without a clear path to future, the American government could usher in its own collapse by just tilting into that unsustainable socialist way of thinking and doing. And I think if you look at society and the influences out there, there are a lot of people ready to accept something like that. Look at the mayor of New York, you know, being elected. He's a socialist. He ran as a socialist and got elected, you know, in a very influential city of New York. the time is ripe for people to latch on to that kind of thinking to save them from what they see as a bleak system with no future for them. When people think they have no future and no hope, they get desperate and they'll reach to anything, turn to anything for help and save them. Currently, you look at the economic situation of the world and how America has had the influence we've had. You know, why is it everybody just does whatever America says? The American GDP, gross domestic product, you know, the total economy of America is at about $31 trillion, and that makes up 1/4 of the entire world economy. And we ain't 1/4 of the population of the world, right? It's way out of proportion to our number of people. Okay, so 1/4 of the whole world economy is America. Our national debt is over $38 trillion, which is more than our total economic activity. And that's only going one direction, which is up, which is a bad indicator for us. And we're just kind of sitting here waiting for a disaster on that, aren't we? Have you not been waiting for a national debt disaster since, I don't know, 9/11, more or less, when it really skyrocketed and started hitting, you know, $3 trillion. I remember it hit $4 trillion. Then suddenly it was at $10 trillion, and now it's at $30 trillion. I'm not sure how it got there, but it happened quick. Maybe it's just because I was having kids and focused on other things. But we're kind of sitting at the brink of disaster as a country with all that other stuff aside. It could be, there's a lot of different disasters, a lot of different ways America could fall. But we know it's going to, and we know why. Ultimately, it's because God takes his hand away because we've chosen other gods as a society. Along with all that, we also have an ongoing geopolitical realignment towards Europe, which the Church of God has long taught that that kingdom with 10 horns and the 10 toes, the iron and clay, is going to be a European system, which is a revival of the Roman Empire. Okay, that has been our teaching. And, you know, we've been preaching that for a very long time, the Church of God has. And, you know, when we look at the last 80 years after World War II, where America has anchored the Western Alliance, and what's happening in the news now? Not only are we 1/4 of all economic activity in the world, we do 37% of all military spending in the world is right here in America. Right? That's why we have the biggest, strongest, most advanced military in the world. But that anchor is now shifting. And it's shifting for reasons that maybe, like, if we're leaning on, like, political theory, like, you know, we might be very in favor of some of the things that Donald Trump says as a president does in terms of America First policies, right? But if you look at it from God's perspective of how things are going to shift towards a beast power, okay, well, suddenly we're telling everybody in NATO, which is pretty much just us in Europe, and there's other people around the world, but it's mostly a European thing other than America, telling everybody in NATO that you guys aren't really committed, you need to step up your spending. And, you know, I think, like, logically, I think, yeah, they ought to pull their own weight. We shouldn't have to, like, pay for their defense, whatever. It makes sense. You know, they're not paying. In fact, he said things like they don't pay their fair share in NATO and these other organizations. He has directly pressured European states to dramatically increase their defense spending, so it's not all resting on us, which I agree is fair. But if you look at the effect that it has, you're basically saying, hey, you guys in Europe, you guys build up your own militaries. You spend the money and you build up your own power. You guys become more powerful. Go do it now. Because we're sick of just carrying the whole weight. What happens when that people comply with that? And they're doing it, by the way. They're trying to, you know, a lot of them, especially Germany's leading the charge, getting their military spending up, getting their own forces much more capable than they have been. So this is all happening. Okay, if we're headed towards, the church has said, based on prophecy, a more powerful European alliance, that's one way that can happen. And I think is happening. I think that's prophecy coming to pass in the news. He also floated the idea of purchasing Greenland. Everybody remembers all that stuff. He's like, we need it for national security. At one point, he even made a comment about sending American troops to secure the assets we need in Greenland. That ruffled a lot of feathers in Europe. So Ursula von der Leyen, she's a German politician who's the current president of the European Union, called that, quote, a line that cannot be uncrossed. For Europeans, a line that cannot be uncrossed. So basically, whether you agree that Trump's policies politically, are good or bad or whatever, the effect that it's having on the world is that Europe is looking at America and thinking, We can't trust and depend on these guys. We have to come together. We have to be our own things. Why should they get to call the shots? How can Americans sit there and bully us and say they're going to send troops to Europe? We can't stand for that. We have to become powerful enough to oppose American influence. It's happening. It's happening. Add to that the pressure of 4 years now of Russia's war with Ukraine, which is at the doorstep of Europe. Like, literally, Ukraine is the last nation on the line before you hit a NATO country. And, you know, Russia and Europe have always had this back and forth distrust. In fact, most of NATO basically exists to oppose Russian influence into Europe and the former Soviet states. So that's just one of many pressures. It's also pushing European consolidation. Germany, which historically has been restrained since World War II, has announced massive spending increases. You know, we watched the whole story, and prophetically, the Church of God has followed along and shown how, like, look, Germany has risen from the ashes and now is the powerhouse economy of Europe. They are funding and supporting all the other European states. You know, I remember back when Portugal and Italy and all these other countries were getting loans from Germany and the church was preaching about it. Like, people should be concerned. Germany is exerting influence and power. And we believe, by the way, Germany is going to be the lead influencer. That's another prophetic teaching of ours. And it's happened economically. And now we're just seeing that shift where it's economically and militarily. Right? That it's now happening militarily. European leaders are openly discussing strategic autonomy, less dependence on Washington, because we pressured them to stand on their own. So they're going to stand on their own. And if they stand on their own long enough, they'll start to see themselves as an independent center of power that can do their will and exert their influence. Alongside all that, so here's a little more to mix in terms of the news and things happening. This one's very interesting to me. I came across this again. I was planning to talk about all this stuff anyway, and this just fell into my news feed. So I don't know if most people know this, but there's been kind of a quiet regulatory war happening between the European Union and American technology companies. So here's what I mean. The European Union keeps passing these laws, a lot of the privacy laws, whatever, basically saying, hey, Google, Microsoft, Meta, you know, which is Facebook, all you companies, you can't collect our people's information in these ways if you're operating in Europe. And what happens is, those companies look at the situation, they get taken to court, they get fined millions, billions of dollars, it's happened with all of them, and in the end, they decide, you know what, it's really not worth it to keep fighting these legal battles in Europe. It's not worth it to split and have like a separate product for America and a separate product for Europe. So what we're going to do is just comply, right? Europe makes the regulation. Their market is too big for these companies to ignore profit-wise, and so they comply with the regulation. Do you see how that kind of matches the idea of economic influence and power that can kind of steer the world economically? Like, they're deciding the policies, and companies across the world are then complying with what the Europeans say. It's too expensive to operate a different way, so Europe is basically regulating globally with their regulations. Yeah, you see that in America with California sometimes. Like, they'll make a law that the automakers have to follow in California, but the California market's so big that if you have to do it for California, you pretty much just have to, like, get your emissions up to standard for the whole U.S. based on California policy. This is not a foreign, you know, new concept. It happens. You know, market size becomes regulatory leverage, basically. So Europe has already had its hand in shaping global digital infrastructure happening, but it hit another flashpoint this week. So the headline I saw is that France looked at it from a national security standpoint and said, you know what, it is not safe for us to have our government depend on American companies for things like Microsoft Teams. Anybody use Microsoft Teams? Yeah, Microsoft Teams is like a business connection software, so everybody can be on a conference call together and share notes back and forth and workspaces and files easily. And, you know, Google's got a similar kind of thing called Google Meet, and you've got, you know, Zoom is another American company. And France said, you know what, we're not going to use any of those American companies anymore. We're going to build our own in-house French company for French digital infrastructure stuff for our government. You know why they did that? Back in May of 2025, last year. Back in May last year, the U.S. government did not like something that one of the EU officials said and some of the policies that they were taking. And so the U.S. government put pressure on Microsoft to deactivate this person's email accounts. And guess what happened here in America? Microsoft did it. They cut the person's email access, so now their email access goes away. So we basically interfered in international politics by pressuring American companies to take this kind of action. That's corruption, right? That's not the American system that I know. You know, that sounds more like what we accuse China of and berate them for. It's like, you know, your companies are controlled by your government. They have to do what you say. And we turn around and have done something like that. And so it's no wonder now the French are developing their own infrastructure for digital communications. And, you know, so that's going to hurt American companies. They're going to lose some pretty big accounts across Europe. France, now that they've raised it, they're not going to be the only ones that do this. Other European companies are going to follow suit. And you're going to have this whole digital divide that just adds to the whole thing. But the part of the story that was interesting to me is not only the technology war going back and forth, but now that subtle part of America drifting away from concepts of free markets, right? Because that's not a free market concept to tell Microsoft you need to go shut down the email service for this person over there because we don't like what they said. But that sounds like a different system encroaching in the minds even of our own government. But also the bigger story is the trust erosion between the power blocks that's happening. You have isolation of Europe from America, America from the rest of the world, that leads to, you know, end time events. Turn with me to Isaiah chapter 24. Isaiah chapter 24 and verse 19. End time prophecy. And one that I've thought about a lot in the last couple of years, it says, the earth is violently broken. The earth is split open. The earth is shaken exceedingly. All right? So it's Isaiah 24, 19. It talks about the earth being broken, split open, shaken. And we know that Christ prophesied there would be earthquakes, right? We can take it in that sense. We can take it in that sense. Yes, there's going to be terrible earthquakes. They're going to shake the foundations of the earth and scare people to death physically. Verse 20 says, the earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, which again, movement of the earth is part of the thing, and shall totter like a hut. Its transgression shall be heavy upon it, and it will fall and not rise again. The part of this that stood out to me and made me really think about it is, you know, is this only earthquakes, like physical shaking that is happening? Says transgression shall be heavy upon it. You know, the root word for transgression there is rebellion. Now, I think we're talking about more than just the physical movement of the earth out of its orbit in this scripture. I think if we kind of step back out of geopolitics that we've been in and look at just culturally, just look at the instability in our culture and in the world and how quickly things change. You know, we see violent cultural swings about ideas of what's good and evil, right? Things that once used to be never talked about openly have become celebrated. 2015 is when gay marriage became the law of the land in all 50 states by a Supreme Court decision. And it only took, you know, less than a decade from that to all of these programs where this stuff is openly celebrated everywhere, and if you don't celebrate it, then you're, you know, going to be in trouble and canceled. And I mean, just think of all that stuff we've been through in the last 10 years or so on that front alone, and how much it changed, right? And over the last year, since, you know, politically America swung back the other way, how long did it take to dismantle and defund all the DEI programs? That was done in the first 2 months, right? The first 2 months of Trump's presidency last year. I think we mostly agree that those things were waste and they were aligned morally with things that we can't be a part of. But if you look at the action taking place, tell me that's not like a drunk person that can't walk a straight line, right? Like, you know, staggering this way, then you stagger this way. And how does it end? It goes back and forth more and more violently until, wham! You hit the ground. I think it's happening culturally. I think it's happening economically, and it's happening in the world in all kinds of different ways. You've also got, on many different fronts in America, division, which has always kind of been there, but you have protests that turn destructive and people burn down whole city blocks or declare an autonomous zone. Look at the things just in the last decade we've had where you know, they went to defund the police and did just all these different things. We've even had, you know, the assassination of Charlie Kirk last year, like turning into literal violence. How about all the threats and assassination attempts of the current president? You've got a lot of this going to and fro like a drunkard, in my opinion. Connecting with this, we didn't read it there, but in Revelation 17, it says that the nations become drunk, right? They're going to get drunk with power. They're going to get drunk with wealth. They're going to get drunk with influence, and drunk people make unstable, bad decisions. So we see the whole world really is at a point where we're in a process of destabilizing. We're destabilizing from, you know, a long time period following World War II, basically, where, yeah, there's been upheavals and problems and whatever, but things have been relatively stable in the sense of the primary system of doing things has been this American-led system. And out of that instability, I believe, we could see the beast power rise. Out of crisis, promising order, promising security, promising economic stability, a solution to this problem of all the AI taking your jobs, you know, protection from your enemies because America's not going to provide it anymore. Many, many different ways that this is going to come about, many different factors influencing it. And the thing is that the whole world's going to accept it, right? When it comes about, whether it's, you know, this year or 10 years from now or 100 years from now, you know, we don't know God's timescale for this, but we know when it does come that people are going to trade freedoms, economic freedoms and religious freedoms. They're going to trade them for what seems like safety. They're going to also trade the truth for lies in the process, and they're going to fall right in line worshiping the beast and its image, whether out of just, you know, devotion for pulling them out of horrible, crippling unemployment, no future for them and their children, or whether it's just pure compliance because they feel like, you know, they know they're going to get killed if they don't worship the beast of this image, right? Because that's part of the deal. And well, what does all that mean for you and me right here today? The danger for me and you is not necessarily AI. It's not what Europe's going to do. It's not what China's going to do. It's not, you know, political policies, universal basic income, left policies, right policies, whatever, or this or that leader. You know, those things are not the danger to us. The danger is a world willing to trade liberty for security, and a world that, you know, is unstable is one thing, but what we do in our relationship with God is what matters. If we are a church that is unprepared to stand apart in a changing world, to stay the course on biblical values and the things we know are right and not compromise with them, that puts us in trouble. You know, Jesus Christ said for us to watch, and so we do watch, you know, the times and events and the headlines and the things happening. He told us to be ready, and he said very importantly, not to be deceived. You're not to be deceived by promises of new miracle technology, new miracle, you know, healing powers of this or that, or whatever that, you know, that beast may eventually pull out. You know, not to be deceived by people claiming to be the Savior, claiming to be the Christ. And that can take different forms. They can say, like, I'm literally like the Jesus Christ. I'm here. Or it can be someone taking a position like Christ. You know, saying, I am the Savior who will save you from all of your problems, which we know the beast will do. So we have to ask ourselves questions like, are we, you know, do we know where our lines are that we wouldn't cross? Are we conditioning ourselves to just go along with whatever a government says is right? Or, you know, are we convicted? On the other hand, are we already finding small ways in our life, maybe unrelated to that, where we're compromising and kind of bending on our convictions for comfort, whether it's the Sabbath or whatever else, you know, something that, ah, man, I need to get that done, but it's the Sabbath, and yeah, you know, I'll just go ahead and do it this time. Small compromises, if we can't, you know, master the small things, probably not going to stand up when the big things come. That's why we have work to do every day, every week. If we can't do that now, you know, before world destabilizing pressures and literal life or death, and when we're literally facing a Satan-led government on Earth, you know, if we can't do these things now, how are we going to do it in the face of all that? So we have a lot of responsibility. The most important thing we can do is to learn to live as people of commitment, who have commitment to the right things, to God, and who follow through and do what we say we're going to do with God and with others. People of conviction, you know, we do this because we believe it is right, and we believe there's a God in heaven who's going to enforce it, and that this is his way, and that I want to be a part of his kingdom. That's conviction. And we do it with courage, meaning it doesn't matter what anybody around me says or does or threatens to do, whether it's an individual or a government or whatever. It doesn't matter. I and my family are going to have to stand on the right things. That's courage. We have to be people grounded in the ways of God, that trust in God, and aren't trusting in our money to protect us, not trusting in a political party to come and rescue us from all this mess, or anything else. But people that identify as citizens of that kingdom is yet to come. And we're going to close out the message talking about that kingdom in Daniel chapter 2. We'll look at verse 44 and 45. Daniel 2. Daniel chapter 2 and verse 44. Yeah, sorry, my pages are sticking together. Daniel 2, 44. We read this earlier, but we're going to focus on it now. In the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. No matter how powerful it looks, when it crushes and smashes and breaks all these other kingdoms into pieces, you know, that the strength of iron smashing these other kingdoms and destroying, no matter how strong it looks, no matter how futile it looks to resist it, this is the end. You know, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, and it shall, it's going to turn the tables, it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces, the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, its interpretation is certain. We go back to verse 35. Verse 35, where it actually describes the dream. I think it says it in a way that's even more powerful than Daniel's summary. That's his summary in the interpretation. Verse 35 says, this is what happened to that statue that he was looking at in the dream. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. Y'all know what chaff is? When they thresh out the wheat, you've got, you know, the discarded parts to the side, and it's just these little bitty bits, and they blow away in the wind. That's what it says will happen. It says the wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. No trace of those other nations. There's going to be no trace of America or Canada or Germany or Iran or, you know, modern nation of Israel. No trace of the governments and the systems, the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know, that we've had. None of that. All of those systems are destroyed and carried away by the wind, as it were. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the future that we hope in. You know, and it's maybe not wrong to hope that things will be better before they get worse in some ways in our country. Hope that our politicians will put in good policies and make good decisions, and we certainly need to pray for them. But ultimately, we know that the Bible describes a failure of the system that we're in. So we don't hope in the system to ultimately solve the problems, because it will not. The Bible describes the rise of the beast, and the preconditions are forming, just like with the state of Israel forming, just like with weapons of mass destruction. We are drifting towards a world of centralized control. You can even just look at the whole of the rise of the internet and globalization and big tech companies as part of that, that makes these things possible. You know, so we don't look at this, we can't set dates. It could take quite a while before any of this comes, or could come very quickly, but we have to recognize that the direction is right in line with the direction Scripture says. The road to the beast is going to be paved with technology and economics and a whole lot of fear and, you know, human wickedness. But there is also a narrow road to the kingdom of God that we need to be on, and it is paved with faith, with endurance, and loyalty to God the Father, Jesus Christ.